What is up, beautiful people, and welcome back to a new episode of the Connect podcast. This is the platform that explores stories of purposeful life lived across and in between cultures and celebrating our common existence and humanity. I am your host, Ghali, and every single week I'll come on here to speak to you guys about some life things or sit down with a guest to speak about things like identity, culture, lifestyle, and purpose. In today's episode, I have psychologist Araikum Kolu joining me and talking all things mental health. I've often thought about the importance of language in psychology and how our cultures can impact not only our understanding, but also our willingness to understand mental health. So we got into that. And also her work creating Safe Space Africa, an entity dedicated to improving mental health for Africans through individual therapy, group workshops, and digital products. Guys, they even have one-off sessions called the Vent Sessions, which I don't know about you, but I've needed a couple of times in my life. We also talk about the hopelessness that many may feel across the world with so many global crises, slowing down, and why purpose is more important than passion. I learned so much from this conversation, even how to talk to my own brain. And I hope that you will too. Let me know what you think across socials. And yeah, I think it's time to get into it. So, Araikum, welcome to the Connect podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we've been trying to get this together for a minute. Mm-hmm. I've been busy, you've been busy. You've moved from Tanzania to Nairobi.
Yes.
How has that shift been for you?
It's good now. Mm-hmm. I feel settled. The cold isn't as cold as it was, I think, like last year when I used to visit, because I think I'm becoming Nairobi resident slowly. I like the green, I like the people. It's a bit faster vibe than Dar, which reminds me of my youth. Yep. So I like it.
Okay. And how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling great. I'm so happy to be here. Happy to not be at work.
It's like when we were in school and you just like any sort of excuse you get to like get out of class.
Right. Right.
Now we're adults with the same sort of feelings.
It never goes away.
Okay, so you are a psychologist.
Yes.
And I want you to sort of retrace those steps for me and tell me about different moments in your life that you think led you to making the decision to become one.
Okay. I mean, I think growing up in the African context, like this isn't a subject, right? Talking about mental health and just behavioral sciences in general. People just exist. And I think in the African context, everyone is a psychologist. Everyone is an expert of how everyone should behave. Yeah. So there wasn't much inspiration. And to, you know, there wasn't much knowledge that this is an industry that exists or that I could become this person. But I do remember very vividly that I've always been sort of interested or going into an analysis of why people are the way they are. My parents come from different cultures, so they behave very differently and would teach us different things separately, and then together, obviously, they come into this foundation, a show for the kids. So for me, that was super interesting. Into you've lived together maybe 10 plus years, but there's still such core parts of both of you that you can't shake away no matter what changes in your life. So I think that was my first, like, okay, this is super interesting. Why does she keep acting this way? But then I still didn't, you know, take psychology or anything like that in school. I had like an intro to psych class, but it wasn't really, you know, it's intro to psych. It's the class everyone takes for fun. And then when I got to uni, I was doing biomedical engineering, which is the very opposite
That's
end.
That's huge though.
I mean, girl, I didn't last more than a semester, so okay. I can't take any credit.
Okay.
Everyone's built for different things, and that just was not for me. Mm-hmm. I felt more challenged, I guess, than I've ever felt in my life. And I kind of had a proper breakdown. And I had to get counseling because of that. And okay. In that process, I realized, my interest in human behavior, here's someone doing this as a job. And then it quickly turned from her helping me into I can do this job. So I then switched to psych. And here I am.
And here you are. So it's really interesting to hear how you went in thinking that you're going to do one thing, and then you came out doing something completely different, because I think that that's a very natural sort of change, but not a lot of people sort of talk about that. You know, you might end up going to uni at like 18 or whatever, thinking that you know what you want to do with your life, and then you just end up rediscovering so many different things, or going through different experiences, meeting different people, role models that may like steer you in a certain direction.
Right.
And how was there sort of a, how easy or difficult was it for you to sort of be like, you know what, I'm giving up on biomedical engineering and I'm actually going to choose this path? Was it something that was easy or wasn't it?
I mean, in that moment, I was doing what a teenager who's just had a proper breakdown would do. Okay. Looking back, there is this side where it's like, you know, when you really hit a wall and it's just like, there is absolutely no way, because that breakdown was actually triggered after a multivariate calc class that I don't think is legal for any 18-year-old to do. And I remember looking in the exam and just writing my name and walking out, because I was like, there's no way.
We've been there.
And so for me, there was literally not a chance that I could actually go back and finish this degree. It didn't matter at that moment who else was involved, like whether I would disappoint a parent or whatnot, which I did, by the way, but I didn't see it that way. I just saw it as I'm literally doing this to save my life. However, looking back now and having worked with a lot of young people who struggle with the same thing, I guess I did have more understanding parents. They were, my mom, not so much. My dad was upset. He was disappointed. He didn't understand psych. It was like saying, I'm studying art, which in itself, there's nothing wrong with that.
Of course.
Right? But for African parents back then. So, but he came around, right? I mean, I think I held my ground enough. And of course, mental health wasn't a topic. So no matter how many times I said, this is super difficult for me, I am struggling, it wasn't landing on ears that had the language to understand. There was no context for it. It's like, we all worked hard. I had to walk blah, blah, blah hours. You know, that speech to go to school.
Yeah.
So looking back, I do realize that, you know, my parents were a bit more understanding than what I do see other people go through, where it's just like proper, you know, cut off.
It can get really bad.
Yeah. It really can.
And so you then, when you finished up college, ended up moving back to Tanzania, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so was the plan always to move back home, or was it something that you were like, you know what, with the psych degree, I can do something back home?
I definitely, I think I was torn, because obviously all my friends were staying in the Western world, in the U.S., and I think very much it was, I can do more back home. I want to be closer to my family. My dad is older, so he had me a lot older. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't really this luxury of like, I'm going to spend the next 10 years building a career outside Tanzania. So it was just, okay, I'm going home. But, you know, whatever I found back home wasn't very supportive of my journey.
But, you know, that's actually really interesting, because it's like you said, it is a sentiment that's sort of found across Africa, like the whole mental health isn't real, or mental health issues isn't real. What is psychology, you know, like why you, I have a cousin who is interested in studying psychology, and she's straight up been told like, you're wasting your time. You know, and I wonder, how have you come to a place where you're practicing psychology, like across these different cultural and religious and traditional beliefs, right?
Yeah. That's a loaded question, Kali. I mean, it's an evolution that happened naturally, right? I wouldn't say I had the answers at 22. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't get a job doing anything really psychology. I was doing user experience research for a big telco. So it was, you know, if I hadn't gone back for my master's, my career could have taken a very different direction and I wouldn't have been in the mental health space.
Okay.
But even after being qualified now and then come back again and still making this decision again that I'm going to still try and make this work, it really is, for me, how I saw it was meeting people where they're at, right? We always, whenever we're introducing something new, we always are thinking about ourselves. Like, I'm the expert. I can't speak to you like you understand me. I have to understand you and speak to you where you're coming from. So if, I mean, there is no religion that actually in a way doesn't talk about mental health, right? There is no cultural, any type of culture in the world that doesn't account for mental health. We've just lost that language because we've created different labeling. Let me call it that, right? So, you know, in Africa, we can say, I don't know, someone was bewitched or something, right?
Yeah.
Or it's like we already have this like solution already created. Like if you are grieving, if you lost a loved one, you have 40 days to do this. And then after the 40 days, you have to step back into your life and you have to pick things up. And it's like, it doesn't work that way. I could be grieving for 10 years and I could not be okay for 10 years, but no one is able to understand that. But things like compassion, things like kindness, right? Things, validation, all these things are in every religion, in every culture. Otherwise, they wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Right? We wouldn't have them existing for thousands of years. So we have to meet someone with the language that they know and then start that conversation from there. Because I'm not going to, someone could be struggling with anxiety and they don't even know they have anxiety. They just know they can't sleep. They just know, I don't know, they struggle when they're out with people. And many other people have probably created a label around that, like you're antisocial, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's so many other ways to look at it. So I'm not going to meet this person, or when we're on social media, we're not going to talk just about anxiety unless it's educational on what anxiety is. But we're going to talk about, you know, those times when you go into a party and, you know, it really feels like you can't talk to anyone. It feels like the room is getting smaller and you may be confident. You practice everything at home, but the moment you get there, you can't say. See, it's so specific. It doesn't matter whether you have the language for it or not. If you felt it, you know you're struggling with that. And I think us taking that, or me having start when we're starting Safe Space, going in that direction, having events and having conversation about just the human experience, that I think changed a lot.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting when you mention language, because it's always something that I've struggled to understand, or at least struggled to figure out how we move forward as a health field in Africa when it comes to mental health specifically, when so much of it is very language dependent, right?
Yep.
And so I remember I was reading an article a couple of years ago, and if I find it, I'll definitely like link it to this episode and share it with you as well. And it was talking about, do you know Dixon Chibanda?
Mm-mm.
He's a Zimbabwean psychiatrist.
Okay.
And he created this innovation known as the Friendship Bench, where they train Zimbabwean grandmothers to do talk therapy with people in their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And this article is basically exploring the origin story of Dixon and, you know, parallel to this other, I think, British psychiatrist. And they're basically talking about how, you know, as close as like the 1960s, where a lot of psychiatrists believe that African people couldn't be experiencing mental health issues because our brains are so primitive. Yeah. And so they connected so many mental health issues, especially depression and anxiety, to be linked to people living in big urban centers.
Right.
So it made sense if you were like in London or New York or Tokyo. But if you're like an African person who lives on their farm in the middle of wherever in Africa, it's not possible for you to be experiencing mental health issues because your life is too simplistic and your mind is just too simplistic too, right? And so then it goes on to talk about Dixon and like the friendship bench and how he had lost a patient because her mother couldn't afford to like bring her to Harare, like to speak with
therapy.
Him. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Or maybe also medication. I don't remember the specifics. And I'm just like, when you think of like this innovation, for example, like training people for talk therapy, when the language doesn't even have a specific word for like depression or anxiety, which a lot of languages don't, how do we even like, you know, begin to create a dictionary or like, you know, a language for mental health on the continent? And so that's something that I'm always sort of like thinking about at the back of my mind. So you talking about language, I'm just like, yeah, it's a huge problem. But meeting people where they are, where they are, is super important too. But you mentioned Safe Space Africa. Tell the people about Safe Space and why it's like so brilliant.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's brilliant, but it's going to be brilliant one day.
Girl.
So Safe Space Africa is a company that I started in 2017. And maybe not to go too much into detail into that whole journey, but right now, Safe Space Africa is basically a platform with psychologists across the African continent, and we're still growing and trying to get as many psychologists as possible to sign up, who provide culturally relevant therapy, virtual therapy, to any African in Africa or diaspora. And the goal is to make it as accessible, as affordable as possible, but to increase the languages offered, right? So even if you wanted to do therapy in your mother tongue and it not in English, to be able to do that, at least that's the goal. And then I don't know when we're going to be able to cover all as many African languages as possible. But also the cultural relevance part, I think that's where even what you were saying before, that we really try to work on. Because while psychology is still like, I would like to say it's maybe a crawling baby now. It was a fetus when I was starting, maybe in 2017.
Yeah.
But I think the industry is born, right? There is a being, but it's maybe not walking yet. Yeah. And I think this is the perfect opportunity to actually step back. And that's something that I'm doing right now, even with Safe Space Africa, is to really remove myself and all the psychologists we work with, and challenge ourselves to think about what other ways of healing, because we're speaking about mental health in general. It doesn't just have to be talk therapy, because we went to school in the Western context to study talk therapy. People have existed in Africa for centuries. Mm-hmm. People have struggled with mental health in Africa for centuries. Maybe we didn't have the language in a way that it's documented somewhere, right, that you can look through. But there are so many social structures that aren't there by accident, right? They're there by design.
Yeah.
If you think about, and I mean, women struggle everywhere, but we can look at this one example. But so many things that African women have gone through centuries of just injustice of, and that's again everywhere, but I'll just speak in African context. There is a lot of social support networks that some of them are being studied. There's an article I'll also share with you. It was published in the African Journal. But some of these social structures are being studied in the context of mental health to be able to methodically say, I guess so that we get some credibility, but that this is also a method that is extremely useful. If it's not talk therapy, if it's within structures that already exist, women braiding each other's hair, for example, there's a lot of conversations that are happening, lots of back and forth in there, right? A trip to the market, a gathering here, a gathering there, going to get water. In what way can we use these platforms and these contexts that happen every single day to be pro-mental health? And we may not say you're clinically treating depression, but if there is someone within your circle that you speak to regularly who is going through, let's say, domestic violence, right? Maybe you cannot help them get out of that situation. That's a very different kind of intervention. But as the surrounding community, maybe not dismissing, right? Learning to not dismiss that this is a really big issue. Learning maybe how to validate, because we do it, but maybe we don't do it in that scientifically correct way, right? Instead of saying like, that's all that's happening to you. At least your husband pays for blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? There's still that language. Yeah. And how can we grow into everyone just learning to be supportive in a mentally healthy, positive way? I think we will go so far because we have so many structures that shield us in so many ways from extreme mental health effects compared to, let's say, societies in the Western world that are very individualistic, right? So even if you're struggling with something and you're literally all alone, you live alone, you maybe don't have that many friends, maybe you're going through bullying, like even the context of just that environment in itself is a huge risk to your mental health. And so talk therapy is the only option there. You must find an external person to talk to because you don't have people around you. So going back to your question about safe space, what we're trying to do now is similar to the friendship bench, that's what it's called, right? Yeah. Don't want to say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
But similar to that, it's like, how can we use existing platforms and bring mental health down to the human experience?
Yeah.
And you're not all psychologists, you're not all psychiatrists, but you are all pro mental health. Yeah. And you can support each other in a very positive way in just everyday conversation.
That's super important, and it reminds me of reading of like sort of research that has been done around like indigenous populations in New Zealand, for example, where they look at, you know, people that are very connected to the land that they're living on, have very many spiritual beliefs about their place in the world, are very sort of connected to community and sort of exist through one another, which also is related to the, I think it's a Zulu word, Ubuntu, and like the concept of like we exist because through each other, and I am because we are. All of that. And it's when looking at populations that have been able to retain those customs and practices, there are so many things, like you said, that protect them against like severe mental illness, right? And so one example would be around now a lot of our sort of urban centers on the continent, we've adopted a lot of Western practices. Like there's a lot of individualism and things like that. And on one hand, like there are certain things that, like, you know, people getting their hustle on is great, you know, but there's also a lot of people who are suffering in silence because of like the extreme pressures of existing in a world where you're just trying to make ends meet.
Yeah.
You're just trying to, you know, get your life going, but there are so many factors that like are against you.
Yeah.
Right. And so one example would be, I have a lot of close friends who are like first-time parents. And for some of them, hey, things are going great, you know? But like for some first-time mothers, it's been a real struggle, you know? And not many people talk about, I'm not even going as far as like postpartum depression, just like general stresses and struggles of being a first-time mom. And so in many of our sort of traditional ways, a child is not raised by one person, right?
Yeah.
Like these pressures aren't meant for just one person. There are grandparents and aunts and uncles and like, you know, an infant can like be told things by someone else and there isn't this like suspicion of stranger danger, you know?
Yeah.
We now live in a very different world where like there might even be people in your family that you're just like, I don't want you anywhere near my future children.
I agree.
And so, yeah, it would be very interesting to sort of see what safe space becomes in terms of that. Because, yeah, there are so many other ways besides, like, talk therapy, right? And even when you said, like, we might not be, like, doing it in the most methodical way or whatever, a lot of, like, research standards and the methods that we use were not created by us, you know? So, like, we're all hitting these targets in these journals and, like, we want to be published in certain places as scientists and health professionals.
Right.
But it's like, is there an appreciation for that cultural nuance? Because not everything is so black and white. And I think that that's also one of the things that I've struggled with when I was, like, in science, because I'm not anymore.
You're like, bye.
I was like, deuces. We're going to try to get to people a different way. But yeah, because like, it's a lot of it is about the numbers, like the data, you know, a lot of it is black and white. And I understand like in a population where their environment doesn't affect them as much as maybe someone living in Nairobi. You know, we need to update some of those practices, in my humble opinion, because, you know.
It's a very valid opinion.
I'm just trying to stay humble, you know, in my opinion.
Don't be.
Not try to call out anyone. Okay, so switching gears a bit. We've been going through a lot lately. The past couple of years have been... I don't even think we have the proper like descriptors for what this time has been. It's just been unprecedented. Our feelings, our emotions, our mental health states, our bank accounts, like everything's just all over the place. And I was having a conversation with someone recently and they were talking about us being present. Like how are we able to be present when there is so much sort of, I guess, despair and hopelessness. So as, you know, a professional, how can we be present to what's happening in the world without giving in to all of the despair and the hopelessness? Because sometimes it does feel like going down like a rabbit hole of just
very
like,
quickly.
Yeah, you know, like you're scrolling, you're seeing one thing, you're seeing 100 things.
Yeah. It's definitely not easy. I feel like during COVID, I don't want to say this sounds wrong, but like our business did the best during that time. But that
I understand though,
and it's why it shows right how it was such a difficult time for so many people. And you know, when there's something in that like magnitude where the whole world is kind of going through it at the same time, there's a very big risk of also getting desensitized. And the desensitization doesn't mean you're not affected by it, but it's an escape also, right? So it's like, whatever, this is not ending. I mean, COVID's COVID, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's and that's also a human, it's an incredible human survival skill.
Yeah.
To be able to desensitize and just switch off.
Because
otherwise it's like, okay, I'm out of here, you know? But otherwise, it's like, in order to be mindful, you also have to, you have to start with awareness, right? So we can't talk about like meditation and all these things that are like, you know, super helpful for everyone to do when you're not, you don't have stock of everything about you. That's this thing that you're saying is all over the place. What is all over the place? Right? Let's start there. Let's have the first question be truly identifying so that you can come face to face with all these things. Because another thing that our mind likes to do when it comes to survival is to really magnify and make super abstract, right? Whenever there's a problem, so that you don't feel attacked, right? So that you feel like, well, if I can't solve this really huge problem, then I don't have to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I can, that way your brain can continue to do daily tasks. It can continue to send you to sleep. It can continue to digest your food. if the problem in front of you is so abstract. But sometimes this is an illusion. Yeah. And it's important to recognize that our brains can do this so that we continue surviving. But it doesn't mean we'll stop surviving if we really do come to face to face. Like, imagine there was a whiteboard and someone was literally just writing down all the things that are wrong. And then you actually faced them. Like, you just looked at this whiteboard and you saw it all. And then the realization that you're still standing there, looking at all the things that are
despite
wrong.
Despite everything,
right? You're not about to pass out because now you're looking at it.
Yeah.
And the thing that happens in that moment is you're sending your brain a very important message. Because remember, our brains are wired for fight or flight, mm-hmm. right? That is our, that like our basal ganglia is literally the part of the brain that was first developed in evolution. So right before we have all this cognitive part that make us super smart and intelligent, we had emotions, very instinctual emotions, which are don't eat that plant because it's poison. Lion is coming, equal run, climb a tree. Very basic, you know,
yeah.
Cold equals get firewood.
Yep.
This was literally all there is. And unfortunately, technology has evolved so much quicker than our brain faculties. And even though we have this huge prefrontal cortex area that does super smart things for us and allows us to build the same technology, the basal ganglia still holds the last say. And when it feels attacked, it shuts off all cognitive functioning and takes all energy into that fight or flight state. Right? So this is why maybe taking a risk on a new business idea literally feels like life or death when your brain's literally processing it like lion in front of you. No, you will not die. It will be okay. But sometimes when you face, going back to that mindfulness now, when you face all of this in front of you and you're still able to function, your brain gets the message. It's like, oh, I miscalculated these neural signals of fear. Right? And really magnified them in a way that's just not real. And these are actually problems that we can solve. And then always to go back to the really just the basic understanding is you control your brain. Yeah, your brain's just a really big complex calculator and it's built to make calculations for you. And unfortunately, it wants to save energy. So it makes all these inferences and categorization. But once you create, you give your brain a problem to solve, it solves it. If you cannot face your problem, you are not giving your brain a problem to solve. And therefore, it magnifies the situation, makes it ambiguous so that you never solve it. And this self-awareness, everyone's always talking about self-awareness, which is like asking yourself the tough questions and whatnot. It's also sometimes, I tell my clients this all the time, have conversations with your brain.
How does that work?
It's just an
because
activity.
I have conversations with myself all the time.
Right.
But is that what you're talking about?
So with yourself is very different because okay. The mind and consciousness is very different with the brain.
Okay.
Right? So the brain, strictly speaking, is an organ that receives input, does brrr, so many calculations gives output, and then you interpret that as your reality. Mm-hmm. So imagine you're speaking to a calculator, not another self that is your mind, if that makes sense, right? Okay. So if a calculator could speak back, it will say, but you haven't given me an equation to solve. Give me an equation so that I can help you solve it. And your brain is very, very good at finding solutions once it has a clear problem to solve. So when you have all these problems in front of you, you can start engaging your brain into doing some level of prioritization, right? This is the most pressing problem for me right now. Now you're engaging emotional seats as well of your brain. So it's doing all of this for you. As you say, this is the most important problem. It's bringing up the emotions. This is what we call emotional intelligence now, being able to identify the difference between sadness and disappointment, for example, right. Because it can't help you resolve that particular emotion if you mislabel it in the first place. And you're the one that tells the brain how to label emotions, unfortunately. So it's this whole cycle of misunderstanding and miscommunication. Yeah. And if we start to look at our brain as just, okay, this is literally my best friend's superpower calculator that is with me 24/7, even when I'm sleeping. So I'm going to be speaking to it, because if I'm not speaking to it, the rest of the world is. And it's creating very different inferences. So I need to pull it back once in a while and be like, hey, we looked at all those social media posts today that really make it look like it's the worst possible scenario. So before you go into your fight or flight mode, please realize that we are actually okay. Like, we are living, we are breathing, we are eating, right? And this isn't about just when we say gratitude. It's literally like facts.
Yeah.
Because your brain doesn't like not facts. This is where it creates something worse.
Yeah.
You want to give it facts. And the fact is, all the work that you are doing for me, it's working. It's fine. We are okay. We actually have more space to do more calculations. Are you ready? Let's go. That sounds really weird as I'm saying, but that's how I speak to my brain. This is me literally having conversations with my brain right now with you. But this is just a very different take on mindfulness, right? Than the typical thing that we hear all the time, which is do yoga, do meditation, go for walks. That's great. Please do those things. Those are so wonderful. But those things create like long-term effect, right? They change your brain neural wiring in the long term, which is super important, so that your brain's able to do this process we're talking about right now for you. But in the meantime, when you are in that freaking out process and you feel like everything is going wrong in your life, this is just one of the things that can bring you back. Another way to look at it is pilot co-pilot, right? It's like, okay, everything's wrong with the plane, but we can't solve anything if we don't know what's wrong with the plane. We just know things are wrong. So let's land the plane or put it on autopilot or whatever and start to do a diagnosis for ourselves. And then your brain being the co-pilot, not the pilot, you are still giving the brain instructions. But if you can't take a grip, your brain takes over, right? It's like co-pilot's not going to let the plane fall. I didn't do it exactly the way you wanted, but I didn't crash the plane, so I did the best I could.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's one job is to ensure that you're alive, you know? So exactly. It's like, if you're not the pilot, then it will take over.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like, all I have to do is make sure you survive.
Exactly.
So if you're not telling me, then I'm going to do quick, you know, calculations of your whole entire existence plus every single thing that's going on here and make the decision for you.
Well, I don't know about people listening, but I'm definitely going to be speaking to my brain very differently. I have like proper meetings in my mind about different things. I'm never speaking to my brain in the way that you've just mentioned. I'm just like always, I don't know. This is a lot to process.
I'm sorry.
No. But like in a good way, I think that a lot of the times we don't understand the way that our body works as intimately as we should.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not just because we're not you know, reading about it or whatever, it's also because, like, the science of the brain is not as developed as the rest of our anatomy.
Right.
So there's still so many things that we don't know about it. So the more that we know, the better we will maybe have in this sort of relationship.
100%. And it's really a muscle, right? This relationship. Yeah. Like, people talk about intuition, right? Intuition is literally just neural cells in your intestine. Did you know that?
Yeah.
And see, from after finding out that, it moved from being this abstract woo-woo thing to being like, oh, that's a real thing. And intuition, those neural cells actually deliver information directly to the basal ganglia, or directly to the core part of your brain. So they've been there since the beginning of time, storing very useful information that don't need your cognitive overthinking to interfere. It's like, I know when there's bad energy.
Listen to me, please.
Listen. Yeah. Listen, from the beginning of time, from your ancestors, I know when someone is trying to hurt you. So if I am going to raise the hairs in the back of your neck right now, you better listen, right? But then with the rest of your brain, you can build that same relationship.
Right.
And over time, as you have these conversations, you realize how much control you have. It's almost scary. It's almost like Limitless, but not like Limitless, you know? Not like that movie, but it's a very different, very sure feeling. You can command and it responds.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. And I wanted to touch on you talking about social media and things like that. And I had to get something out of one of the blog posts that you wrote. So in one of these blog posts you had written, so when I see posts about productivity and taking this time to work on yourself, the entrepreneur in me is like, let's go. But then the psychologist in me is like, no, it's not time for anything. Let's slow down. Not a single person alive today has any experience with whatever our reality is right now. None of us have lived through a global pandemic before. All of our lives were turned upside down and we're expected to still be on top of everything. Well, guess what? If you're staying on top of an upside down world, then you're also hanging upside down.
Yeah.
So basically we're all just, we think we're surviving, but we're hanging upside down.
Yeah.
And so in the very sort of like grind culture that we live in, and where all of us are just trying to survive and thrive. I always wonder, is slowing down a luxury that we all have? Because for some people, you can slow down. And you have the ability to. But for a vast majority, especially when we look at the continent as a whole, many people might not have the luxury to slow down. Or does slowing down have different definitions depending on who you are?
I think that's like a really, that's an extremely important point to keep in mind, because things can never look the same for all of us, right? In Kiswahili, we have a saying in Tanzania that says, vidole vilingani, meaning like, oh, you have five fingers that make up a hand, but they are all different, right? But they're still fingers. And it's a very interesting saying when we apply to this, because when I said slow down in that article, I am talking about your emotional expenditure, right? Your energy, whether that's physical, that's emotional, that's spiritual, just your energy in general, because we have a limited tank. And we live in a world that doesn't acknowledge that we have a limited tank. It's like, go, 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 go in every area.
Yeah.
There is no way we are not going to be burnt out by the time we're like 40. We're going to just, our brains are going to be like, bye.
People are burning out in their 20s.
I mean, I've already gone through that first phase.
I've been there.
You know?
Yeah.
But what is important to recognize is it's all coming from the same tank.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, I can have this conversation with someone maybe that's in a maybe entry-level job in an industry that's super competitive, super like, you know, go, 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 go. And it's like, obviously you have the privilege to be able to slow down and be like, well, the world is upside down, so I'm going to take a break to figure it out, or I'm going to work a few fewer hours. But I can't do that, right? I have a boss, and like maybe it's so easy to replace me. This is just the way the industry is. I need the money, right? There's no way I can exist without my salary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if we were to do an audit of this person's entire life, right? Not just the work that they're doing. If we looked at the social life as well, right? And I don't know if it's different in Kenya, but in Tanzania, we expend a lot of energy socially, mm-hmm. right? And it's not just for fun, not for things that I want to do, but for things that I must do for my family.
Responsibilities.
Right, right. And then even just like weddings, funerals, just social things that like for you to maintain this community and be a part of something, you must show up. You must be able to remember to call certain people, right? You must send a michango, rusi and danini. Mm-hmm. These are all coming from the same tank, guys, right? It's not that different. And this burnout that we're talking about doesn't just come from work. It can come from all those things, like the new mother, the expectation to do everything right. Being able to slow down in that context doesn't mean don't take care of your baby, but perhaps not caring about certain things that you know aren't super necessary, but everyone makes it seem like it's super necessary.
Yeah.
But being able to take a step back actually and realize that for me, it's never been that important maybe that my baby does something a certain way. Yeah. But because I see it everywhere on social media or whatnot, I have to do it. So it's really about looking at the entirety of your life and just saying, I'm going to let go of this one area because I'm exhausted and I don't know what is going on. And I'm trying to stay on top of a lot of things. And right now, this isn't a priority.
Yeah.
And you can be compassionate. You don't have to be rude maybe about being like, I'm not going to be able to attend certain things or certain family events or whatever, but there's ways to do it in a compassionate way. And you know what, if people don't understand, that's also a skill. It's not a being rude thing. Mm-hmm. It's an emotional intelligence thing to be able to gauge what you are able to take at a given time and to be able to communicate it effectively without offending anyone. So maybe that's a skill to work on.
Is there something that you've had to let go for those reasons?
100%. Maybe too many things. One, I think within my business itself, I really had to just make a proper decision to close our physical office, which also meant certain people losing their jobs. Though we tried to continue at least to pay them half of their salaries for a few months because it was COVID. But there was no way I would have been able to manage that at that time, right? And then, you know, in my personal life, I feel like there's so many things that I still give up on a daily basis that as I grow and check in, and it's like, this was important to me 3 years ago. Why am I still doing this?
Yeah, no, I totally hear you. And I think that sometimes, like, there is sometimes a guilt that comes, especially when it's around like family and friends, where you may not have that energy to like give everyone or to show up fully. Yeah. And so you take a step back, and then sometimes people understand and sometimes they don't. And growing that thick skin to be like, you know, it may not be something that you want to hear, but for my well-being, for my own survival, I need to be able to do this. It's not easy to like, because I feel like that's like a muscle as well, like to practice enforcing those boundaries.
100%.
And I don't know why this is sort of reminding me. I was scrolling on Twitter a couple of days ago and I came across this. Have you heard of the Reddit thread, Am I the Asshole? Where people just put in. Have you?
No.
Okay, so on Reddit. See,
these are one of the things I've given up in my personal life.
The social medias. So on Reddit, there's this, I guess, a forum or whatever. It's called Am I the Asshole? And so people put in these scenarios and the general Reddit population can be like, hey, yes, you're the asshole. No, you're not. Mm-hmm. And there was this girl that had put in, this question where she was just like, oh yeah, so I'm a new mother and sometimes my mom helps me with the newborn. And so I was over at my mom's house and my 19-year-old sister was there and my mom wasn't around and I wanted to take a shower and the baby was sleeping and I asked my sister to just watch the baby for a couple of minutes while I'm in the shower. Mm-hmm. The baby's asleep, so, you know, he, she, they don't need anything. And her 19-year-old sister was like, no. And the sister's looking at her like, but you don't need to do anything. The baby's asleep. Just in case she wakes up, just like check regularly, you know, or keep an eye. And the sister was just like, no, if you can't take care of the baby, you shouldn't have had it to begin with. This is not my job sort of like energy, right? And so I'm reading this and I'm just like, this is the craziest thing. And so she adds that like her mom came home a bit afterwards. The 19-year-old was like, you should just wait until mom comes home and she'll happily help you, you know? And so when the mom came home, the mom was pissed because she's just like, just watch the baby. Like, it's not asking for much. And the 19-year-old's just like, I didn't sign up for this, basically. And so someone had commented and they were just like, this is like the perfect example of like, I don't owe anyone anything, which is also like a sentiment that's become more popular now that like people are just like, oh yeah, you know, like I don't owe anyone anything. Like I don't have to do any of these things. And so I feel like that's like the opposite, very Western individualistic sort of, on the spectrum of, you know, enforcing your boundaries and just being a complete asshole.
Right,
basically.
I mean, that's too much. Sorry, there's no other way of looking at it.
I was shocked.
I'm just going to give, psychologists, we don't normally give opinions, but I'm giving my opinion because she's not my client.
Exactly.
And that's wrong in my book. That's selfish. That's the right word. And I would really like to emphasize that when we say create boundaries, that is not what we mean. And I think Gen Z especially need to hear this more than any other generation because they really are swallowing this whole, like, I don't owe anyone anything. And it's just...
life doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Like, it really doesn't. But yeah, no, as we were talking, I'm just like, I don't know what triggered me remembering that, but...
I mean, it's a great example for us to be able to differentiate also, of course. Right?
There's one thing, like, being like, oh yeah, family members are, like, asking me for money and I don't want to give them money. It's a whole other thing, being like, a baby's asleep, just check if they're awake or not, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And also, like, I feel like it's important to be like to emphasize that boundaries aren't meant to be set in stone, right? Yeah. It's not a country boundary. You know what I mean?
And even those sometimes are fluid, you know, depending on who you are and how much power you have,
and sometimes depending on the tide level of an ocean that separates or a lake that separates two countries. No, it's not set in stone. I mean, I think you also have to build boundaries that are, I mean, in a way, if you should look at it that you create boundaries to reflect and to communicate who you are. So if you are a selfish person, communicate that as this example was, right?
Yeah.
If you are a person who is emotionally healthy and emotionally aware of what they are able, right? Because able and willing are two different things, right? There, you can be at your peak when it comes to helping family members, let's say, with money, right? And you're able to do it, but you don't want to.
Right.
And that's okay, but not that you never do it. Yeah. I feel like those are two different things. You know what I mean? It's not that that boundary means that you should never, because you owe no one anything. There is also a lot of good that comes from giving. whether that's your time, whether that's your energy, right? There's also an amazing experience to look after a baby. That's especially that's not yours and can return them.
Exactly. This is what I keep saying. It's brilliant.
Right? It's your niece or nephew. I mean, they're so cute.
I love it.
And you can just watch them for a few minutes and feel good about yourself. Like, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Honestly, I would take them for the entire day. I'll just give them back to you.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, I'm absolutely fine with that. And,
Yeah, I've been a pseudo mom for my nephews the last few years. So aww. I really, like, hearing that, I'm just like,
it's the wildest thing. It's the wildest thing.
I don't know. Everyone's different, but
of course.
I think self-awareness also means, and maybe being a 19-year-old, she thinks that's fine. But, you know, growing up, you also can't live in a world where you are that, like, shut off.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, like, we're also very malleable as human beings. Like, 19, you know, who knows, like, just a few years can create so much change. Yeah. So there's also, like, the space for people to grow and to learn and, you know, just see the world differently. And also sort of giving ourselves that space and grace to do it, as well as other people, is incredibly important. But I always admire, like, people who are able to, like, find the things that move them.
Mm-hmm.
And which is also why I created this podcast, and it focuses on people that live life very purposefully, in whatever form that takes, because that can also evolve throughout life. You know, we're not stuck on one path. But I don't remember if it was in a blog or whatever, but you were sort of speaking about purpose versus passion. And so I want you to touch upon why you consider purpose to be more important than one's passion.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's so many reasons, because I think I talk about this topic anytime I can get the chance.
Oh, that's great.
No, just because, like, I really, being a psychologist, I think we see a lot of things that become buzzwords and sell, right? And for me, I get very triggered because I can see when wrong information is sent because things get popular, right? And a passion, like, the word passion itself has never been a word that has ever been used in the English dictionary since the beginning of time as something that's permanent. Right? It is not a long-term thing. How many passions have you had up until today?
I currently have multiple. Like, it's, you know.
Right. So, just with that alone, like, there's no way you can, and I think it really misguides young people, right? Where it's just like, you know, I'm so passionate about, I don't know, whatever maybe is in and trending. I'm passionate about social media, so I'm going to become a social media management and digital manager. There, in every single industry, there are good things and there are bad things.
Right.
And you cannot get through the bad things because you were passionate 3 years ago. When you're not getting promoted, when the pay is not increasing, when life responsibilities keep
coming up. When you need
up,
to get out of bed in the morning.
When you need to get out of bed in the morning and you look at this job and it's like, wait, this is not what I want to do. Mm-hmm. But you're passionate about it a few years ago.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. So for me, passions are things that come in, they're seasons to teach you something. And the most privileged and luckiest of us will have the opportunity in their lifetimes to explore multiple passions, because you'll always walk away with a different skill, with a different awareness of the self, of the world. You will meet people. So it's an amazing thing to do. However, it's not going to sleep with you and cuddle you at night when you're crying about your pain not increasing. You know what I mean? It's not going to give you the emotional blanket of, like, we still have to get through this. We have to make it work. You have to have a cause for that. You have to have something that's deeply moving, something that really, really, it just triggers you. Like, knowing that this is the thing that exists and I exist and I must enact change in this thing.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, that's a huge change in terms of, like, development work, or it's literally just change in terms of, I don't know, I need to change the formula of Nutella. I don't know.
Oh, no, we're not doing that.
I mean, I don't know. All I'm saying is, like, I mean, person who created Nutella, super rich, right? Mm. It doesn't mean that if you're going to change the taste of, or the formula of Nutella, that it's going to take you only, you know, a couple of days to do that. For you to perfect it and it good. It could be a 10-year thing that you're doing that everyone thinks you're crazy while you're maybe doing extra jobs, and then boom.
But you have the vision.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you keep working on it for years and years. And everyone who listened to you was like, what?
Yeah.
But that new Nutella taste, not only does it make you super rich, obviously, all the smiles it brings to kids' faces, to people's faces, right? It's Nutella, and you made it better than Nutella. I mean, you created joy in chocolate.
Honestly, if someone's actually able to do that, like, that would be, yeah, jackpot.
And that cannot be a passion. For example,
that's a purpose,
right? That's a purpose.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to say by these two examples is, it doesn't matter if your purpose seems small to you, right? Someone, I use this example all the time, right? And that's Oprah. Oprah's like purpose was to connect people by telling stories, kind of like the Connect podcast.
Hey,
shameless plug. But that was Oprah's purpose. However that would look, you don't have to figure out those details, right? Unlike your passion, because it's short term, you have to figure out, like, okay, I'm going to work for this job and this company and whatnot. And her career had taken many uncomfortable turns and unexpected turns for her to be able to sit in that chair, talk to someone who was not famous, actually, at the time. They were, I don't know, in some ad, a local ad or something. But she brought out in this person only what Oprah could bring out in people. And then the rest is history, right? She didn't have to figure it out. That's just what she wanted to do and what she knew she had to do. And that's with everybody else, too. Find your purpose. Now, by me saying there's a difference between the two doesn't mean passions are less than. Doing different passions helps you get to your purpose, because we're not born knowing, right, what our purpose is. And one of the ways you know that you're not doing your purpose is if you're super unhappy right now, right, with whatever it is that you're doing. And I'm not saying you're unhappy because of the pay or things like that. Like, you are genuinely within yourself. Everyone knows this feeling when we're talking about the human experience.
Absolutely.
That feeling of, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do, or I'm not just living my potential. This just is not my life. And you could be making the most money, and people walk away from that every single day. There's people walking away from six-figure jobs, things that are dreams to young people or anyone, really. And then you get there and realize it's not enough, eh? It's just not
enough.
It's really not. You can only go to so many vacations before it really becomes just another flight to another blue place with another ocean. That's the human experience. We're meant to experience.
Yeah.
So do the passions, but it's just recognizing that it may end, and you're allowed to change, and you're allowed to grow, and you're allowed to find your purpose.
I think that that's actually, like, the most sage advice to come to come out of this episode, is just, you know, live your life and be able to explore and see where your path takes you, you know, like, follow your curiosities. And this episode is definitely going to be in, like, my top two favorites.
Oh.
No, just because I think that there's a lot of universal truth when it comes to mental health and us just living fulfilled and balanced lives. And to be able to hear it from someone that can actually give people a more, you know, objective and structured view, rather than, you know, the quotes that we're bombarded with, or, you know, the very sort of surface level, like, band-aid solutions to things. Is something that I think a lot of people are going to appreciate when they hear. So I want to thank you for coming on to The Connect. And I will definitely be sharing your socials in the description of this episode and the Safe Space website.
Yeah.
And people can actually find therapists on there, right? So if you are someone who is struggling and is looking for more contextual talk therapy, you can actually find it at the Safe Space.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for joining, Arika. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I did. Thank you so much for having me. And just little plug in there that actually you don't have to be struggling to go to therapy.
Hey.
We actually have a session that we call the vent session. And these are one-off sessions that you can book with psychologists to talk about just literally maybe anything that you're going through and struggling to process or trying to find actual solutions to something that's going on in your life right now that maybe isn't long-term type of program.
I love that. The vent sessions. Oh my goodness, that's actually great. And thank you all for listening. This has been The Connect, and I will see you back here next Wednesday. Thank you so much, and bye.
Bye.